from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Toward the end of the 19th century, the Victorian writer and social critic Oscar Wilde declared that art never expresses anything but itself. Wilde's observation calls to mind the notion of art for art's sake alone, an aesthetic preserve with no necessary social or practical dimensions. But is this conception of modern art too narrow? Should art in some way tell us about ourselves and the world we live in? In two separate conversations, Soundings put those questions to a scholar of philosophy and aesthetics, Arthur Danto of Columbia University, and to an art historian who is also a museum curator, Michael Shapiro of the St. Louis Art Museum. Arthur Danto teaches philosophy at Columbia University. He's the author of The Transfiguration of the Commonplace, A Philosophy of Art, published in 1981 by Harvard University Press. Arthur, we have a difficult task here. We're on the radio and we're going to talk about art. Yes. We don't have pictures to show to our audience. So let's sort of step back from a discussion of philosophy and aesthetics and the visual arts and talk at a very general level. Let me ask you this. How is it that philosophy can lend insights into the visual arts? How do you make the connection between those two?
I suppose that the visual arts aren't all that visual, for one thing, and particularly in the present century, experiments by people who began as painters but found themselves raising conceptual questions about the nature of painting and ultimately the nature of art, hence philosophical questions internal to the work that they were doing, makes it inevitable that philosophy has got to come into the picture. These are philosophical questions being raised by artists about art, and it's perfectly clear that they can't be answered in visual terms.
Give me an example of a question that
the person that I think of as in some ways the great artist of the 20th century is Marcel Duchamp. Mm-hmm. People think of him as, in many ways, a kind of kibitzer on the peripheries of the art world. But I think Duchamp really did raise more than any philosopher had raised, and certainly more than any artist had ever raised, the philosophical question of the nature of art in the following way, by particularly with the ready-mades, his set of works that Duchamp began to do 1915, 16, 17, where he took quite ordinary objects and scarcely modified them at all, and then presented them as ready-made works of art, not because they were aesthetically interesting. In fact, one of the criteria for picking a ready-made was to find something as dull as it could be, mm-hmm. A snow shovel, a grooming comb, something of that sort. What's interesting about Duchamp is that he'll take an object and say, this is a work of art, and it really is. So the first question is, what makes it to be one, mm-hmm. since something that looks exactly like it and is just an ordinary object isn't?
Okay, so what's the difference? Let's assume that we're talking about a can of soup or something like that.
That's just what we've got to find out. I mean, that's where the philosophical question comes in. What difference does it make? You've got here the question of my child could have done it. Well, yeah, your child could have done it. There's nothing difficult. It's not like painting the Sistine ceiling or anything of that sort. You don't have to go to school for years and years and develop marvelous reflexes. What you have simply to have done is to have internalized the history of art and mm-hmm. realize that this is a significant gesture to have made, a significant question to have raised, and it's not totally conceivable that any child could have done that. That required a person of immense sophistication and basic philosophical intuition.
Arthur, you've written a book called The Transfiguration of the Commonplace.
Yeah.
You're talking here about, you've been discussing an artist who, as you say, has absorbed the history of art and in that sense change the ground rules for himself, if not for his audiences. What do you mean by the transfiguration of the commonplace? You mean just taking dog biscuits and putting them on a pedestal and saying, wow, we have art?
I was interested in that, yeah, uh-huh. Particularly. I mean, it's not something that could have happened before the 20th century. Not the great art historian Heinrich Wolfflin says not everything is possible at every time. Mm-hmm. This was historically possible for some reason.
Is it possible now because we're intent on theory that we're trying to figure
partly
out what art
true.
Is?
Partly that's true, that in a way, just as I was saying, the dog's comb, the work isn't the comb, but the question raised by the comb, by means of the comb, so the comb itself gets transfigured into a philosophical problem. At this point, probably, the question having been raised by means of those objects, it's not so clear that the question has to go on being raised. Mm-hmm. And so could this be one, could that be one, is not as interesting a question with those objects. Yeah, the answer is they could be, so there's no point in them being, if you see what I mean. It's a little bit like a joke. It can be told once. That question has been raised. Well, Duchamp did it on several different occasions because I suppose he was exploiting the dimensions of the question. Certain of the objects were quite incendiary in a way. Warhol took the same thing up with the tomato soup can, the Brillo box.
Yeah.
And so forth. But I stole the title, The Transfiguration of the Commonplace.
Who'd you steal it from, and what does it mean?
It came from a novel by Muriel Spark called The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Oh, yeah.
And the heroine, well, one of the heroines of Miss Jean Brodie is a young woman, Sandy Stranger, who becomes, in the course of the book, converted to Catholicism, as I guess Muriel Spark herself underwent a conversion. And she writes a book called The Transfiguration of the Commonplace, when she becomes a nun, Sister Helena of the Transfiguration. I loved that title. I thought one of these days I'm going to write a book and use that particular title.
Well, so are you talking here about fundamentally spiritual, if not religious, concerns?
A little bit. Yeah, bit like that. Yeah. I'd say that in whatever way a certain ordinary object gets suffused with holiness, one might say.
The bread and water of the mass.
Something like that is a good case.
All
that
right.
Something like that takes place with these quite ordinary objects, that they suddenly become exalted and transfigured into works of art. I don't feel as though a really satisfactory philosophy of art could have been achieved before the 20th century, because I don't think the full conceptual possibilities of the world of art were available to people before that time. So only in the 20th century was it possible for philosophy to really enter the picture and have a fully, the possibility at least of a fully satisfying answer to the question.
Okay, now is that because philosophy itself was immature?
No, philosophy has to, like everything else, deal with what it's got. I have a feeling that philosophy and art have been very closely connected. I think philosophy really begins with the existence of representational art in ancient Greece. It's what really got Plato going. What's philosophy without the distinction between appearance and reality?
Mm-hmm.
There's Plato saying, here is an apparent object. Everybody's taking it for a real object. So in what does the difference consist? And that's the irritant gets Plato to secrete what we now think of as philosophy. And I think that philosophy and art probably are together at the end too, in the sense that finally it's as though the nature of art has worked itself out through history to the 20th century, and it's in a way possible to answer the question that Plato raised. So at least that's a point at which philosophy, what does philosophy do here? Philosophy tries to offer partitions between Well, basically different kinds of things. And the first thing you're saying about works of art is they belong with a class of things mm-hmm. in connection with which the question, what's it about or what's it mean, makes sense. Next question would be, how do you distinguish it from within that domain mm-hmm. and so forth? So the division between, well, art and reality certainly at least begins there. Art belongs, contrasts with reality, at least in that sense that it's about something. There would have been a period, as I say, where there was a kind of consensus sometime maybe during the 19th century where and anybody could in a certain way. It's not that the objects were less complicated, it's that everybody was had a fairly good idea of what was going on.
And kind of a contract between the artist and the
exactly
audience.
Exactly that. And then when the contract begins to get broken by, mm-hmm. say, people like Manet, mm-hmm. and then the Impressionists, and mm-hmm. good God, the post-Impressionists, there's a rage almost as though we've been betrayed. This is not how we learned to do this, and so forth. And I think that there was genuine pain on the part of people. You don't see that much anymore, which means, I think, that though probably more people go into galleries than have ever done so in the history of art, everybody now realizes that a job of work's got to be done, that a lot of explaining has to take place before these objects are accessible. Even you can see them. Any dog can see one of these things, but that's just the
seeing
beginning.
Is one thing, appreciating is another.
Yeah, and I mean, even if in the end all it is seeing, you've got to go through so much theory.
Arthur, let's conclude with a bit of an uppity question here.
All right.
Which makes some...
For all the uppity answers.
Right, and you tell me what the hidden assumptions are. People walk into an art gallery, and they look at it, and they look at the objects inside, and many times the reaction goes something like the lyric in the old Peggy Lee song. Is that all there is?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why? What are we missing? Who's failing to connect?
I don't want to say that that's always wrong.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that may be all there is. You know, not everything that gets in a gallery is a masterpiece.
Uh-huh.
But I think you probably could have said that about a lot of art down the history.
Okay,
is that all there is? And
I'm talking about modern art.
Yeah.
Yeah, just in a general sense. Why is it difficult for general audiences? Should general audiences not necessarily...
I think it's difficult for general audiences only because general audiences don't like to think, maybe. And mm-hmm. you've got to think. That's an uppity answer. In order to get to first base, you might find when you get to first base that there is no second base. There is only first base. But to get there, at any rate, you've got to do something that people aren't prepared to do. As long as you think of art as entertainment, as long as you think of art as there to please mm-hmm. The senses, you're not going to get much out of a lot of what goes on. You go into a gallery and you see a pile of hemp rope on the floor, or you see a piece of slashed felt hanging on the wall. There's not much to get out of that stuff. Well, from that point of view, it's like marriage. It's like anything else, you know. Just sort of enter a marriage relationship and it's bliss. You really have to work at those things, or a career, or life. I mean, it's like that.
The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. You're listening to a discussion about art and society. In the preceding portion of the program, my guest was Arthur Danto of Columbia University. Arthur Danto is the author of The Transfiguration of the Commonplace, A Philosophy of Art, published in 1981 by Harvard University Press. Soundings on Art and Society concludes now with a conversation featuring an art historian. Michael Shapiro also serves as curator of 19th and 20th century art at the St. Louis Art Museum. Before taking his position as a curator, Michael Shapiro taught at Duke University and completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about marble carving and American sculpture. Mike, let's begin our conversation about sculpture. art history. I've got a magazine here in front of me, and I'm reading from an advertisement which says, a renowned Western artist creates a powerful new work in the rich tradition of bronze horse sculpture. Now tell me, you're an art historian, and you're a curator in a museum. Does this kind of thing cheapen art and sculpture? How does an art historian or a curator look at the movement of this kind of art and sculpture from the domain of the rich and the powerful down into the sort of popular league?
I think most people view it with contempt or at least extreme dismay, because it's taking what they say is the tradition of great creative sculpture and reducing it to the level of a postage stamp, which can be purchased by anyone and which may, in a certain sense, resemble great works of art, but it doesn't have any of the historical or technical or rich traditions mm-hmm. which make a sculpture important for a museum or for a culture. So when we see these ads, which have proliferated all over because people are interested in Western American subjects, and people like the company that made that ad are trying to capitalize on that interest.
Well, why is that a bad thing? Don't you art historians and art curators, don't you want many people to be aware of what you call the tradition in art and sculpture? Does it have to be an object of art? Does it have to be unique? Does it have to be in a museum? Does it have to belong to a single individual? Why can't I have a copy?
That's exactly right. You certainly can have a copy, and you're entitled to it. Mm-hmm. But I think we would all like people to enter into their purchase of an original cast or a recast of a sculpture, being aware of its value, its significance, or its lack of value and significance. So you should be aware of how far away a sculpture is from the actual hand of an artist. And in a way, that's something that I've been working on in my project here at the center as far as marble sculpture is concerned. But it's a concern of mine both in 19th century bronze sculpture and 19th century marble sculpture. And I think Frederick Remington's bronze equestrian subjects are an extremely fine example mm-hmm. of great works of art which are now available in all sizes, shapes, and forms.
And do you approve of that?
Well, I feel as though part of my job is to protect and explain the importance of his creative acts. And when there's a 2-inch high reduction, which barely resembles the original 24-inch sculpture, then I feel as though I have to make those distinctions mm-hmm. sharply felt in the minds of the public. But one of the problems with sculpture that we really should direct ourselves to is the fact that, unlike painting, it is a reproductive medium, which means that we can have several or many different casts or replicas of a sculpture. And it raises all sorts of questions about authenticity, a relative value and merit, both within an artist's life or perhaps if production continues after his lifetime. So that the whole nature of sculpture as a medium is fraught with intellectual, almost philosophical problems that you don't find in painting.
Where is the emphasis? Is it on the known and the, in other words, a sort of pool of talent that you draw on? How much do you bring in the new talent? How aggressive are you in seeking out?
You mean contemporary sculptors?
Well, contemporary or historical. How aggressive are you in bringing to the attention of the public material that may not be known? And in other words, adding it to the canon, that kind of thing.
Well, I think that sculpture, one should start by realizing is a stepchild to painting, and as a result has not nearly been as carefully studied, there are far fewer sculptures on permanent exhibition in museums in America and Europe than there are paintings or drawings, for that matter. So I feel as though one of my jobs is to bring to the attention of the public, scholarly and otherwise, overlooked, understudied, but highly talented sculptors, because the whole history of sculpture is up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
No one has written a really persuasive history of modern sculpture.
You mean defining it, explaining its origins, all of that?
The origins and creating a kind of sequence which we find, the sequence of isms that you find in 19th century painting, neoclassicism, romanticism, realism, impressionism, that's not parallel in sculpture, and there is no historical structure which has been persuasively formulated for 19th and 20th century sculpture.
Why is that necessary? Why do you have to have some sort of theory of sculpture apart from just appreciating the works
That's a valid format, that is, appreciating it for yourself, but at the same time we are historians, mm-hmm. and we're trying to place them in a point in time and in a sequence of moments.
Let me follow that up. I want to talk to you in a moment about your project at the Humanities Center, but do you have any rules of thumb about developing a sense of art and art history with regard, for instance, to your interest in sculpture or broader generalizations than that? How does one go about sensitizing oneself?
I think that it's like, how do you become an artist? There isn't
or
any
swimmer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's no set formula. But I think your swimmer analogy indicates that you need practice is one thing. And I would think, try and see works of art which are said to be important, and try and figure out why. Try and relate them to other sculptures in the area, and go with someone that you can talk to about it, and perhaps make a little sketch of something that you like,
mm-hmm.
or discuss the form, then find something written about an artist that you're interested in, and then go back. I think, Wayne, I think that going back to a work of art that you like after an hour or after a day or after a week, you teaches you the richness of a work of art, because it's different. You've changed.
Every time.
Mm-hmm. You'll see something differently. You won't remember it as it really was. The work of art, hopefully, is maintained in a sort of constant state, but it's we who change.
Mm-hmm. That, in a way, is consistent with your research at the Humanities Center, Mike. To what degree would you say that marble and bronze have been neglected in American art history?
Well, it's only in the last 15 years that a small number of historians have begun producing serious monographs on American 19th century sculptors, and that we have turned, as we've turned to American landscape painting, to appreciate the inventions of mm-hmm. our own sculptors.
How big a body of work are you talking about to which attention has only turned here?
Well, there were vast amounts of marble that were carved and imported to this country, many of which have disappeared. But a number are reappearing
mm-hmm.
As their market value increases. So in this case, the market is a great historical tool. But it's only been in the last 10 years that both bronze and now marble being produced by traditional means have become close to the forefront of contemporary sculpture.
Mike, let's come back to some of the comments that you were making a few minutes ago about marble and bronze in American art. Are there recognizable themes, continuities that you trace as an art historian?
Rather than recognizable themes, I would think the quest for American themes itself becomes the major theme. Mm-hmm. I think it's an unrealizable dream, like the great American novel. But short of saying something kind of pedestrian like lots of Indians and occasional cowboys, I think it's the idea of finding the search for something which is an American subject, which invigorated a lot of 19th century sculptors. I think today you'll find American sculptors reacting to a more international context, that their forms are as appropriate, should be as appropriate to Western Europe as they are here. But one of the interesting things today is that a number of painters have turned to sculpture in the last few years and have created very interesting bronze sculptures. There's a kind of bandwagon effect that seems to have developed. And a number of bronze founders have told me that painters are freer of the traditions of sculpture making and perceived limitations than are trained sculptors, so that they have brought a freshness of viewpoint and of technical attitude to the medium, and have brought about or helped contribute to this invigorated sculpture scene. And one of the things that I'm presently involved in and eager to communicate is the vibrancy of American sculpture at the present moment. I don't think it's been sufficiently recognized, but among the most interesting and important contemporary art is sculpture. Mm-hmm. More and more painters have turned to it. More and more sculptors have refined their viewpoints and have turned to once traditional methods in an avant-garde mm-hmm. manner.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a two-part discussion about art and society. My guests were Arthur Danto of Columbia University and Michael Shapiro of the St. Louis Art Museum. Before taking his job as a museum curator, Michael Shapiro completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project about marble carving and American sculpture. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of conversations about 19th and 20th century American literature. My guests will be Lucinda McKeithen of North Carolina State University, Ann Jones of the University of Florida, and John Sikora of North Carolina Central University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.